In the pre-advertisement part of the show, we were kind of talking about the World War One, which I love doing at this time of this century, at least. It's always helpful to go back a century to see where we've come from, see where we're going. And for our counterparts that were around in 1915, you know, within one officer's career arc, they saw American Navy move from the Great White Fleet through the Spanish-American War to the age of the dreadnought, and showed up towards the end of World War One with a very, very different Navy than what the ensigns of that time may have seen when they were young pups at the end of the previous century. We also saw an army that was an ad hoc army of lots of volunteer units into a world-class army that really set the tone for what would follow to be the pivotal event for this nation of that century, World War II. And what we're going to do today is we're going to use it as a base, as what we did to build up and prepare for World War One. Not just the Navy, we'll look at the larger defense establishment, and we have the ideal guest today on to discuss that, and also some broader topics of how things have developed today that we can definitely learn from the past. For the full hour, we're going to have our returning guest, Dr. John T. Kuhn. He's the General William Stauff Chair for Historical Research at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He retired from the U.S. Navy back in 2004 after 23 years of service as a commander. He was a naval flight officer on both carrier-based and land-based aircraft. He's taught a variety of subjects, including military history, since 2000 at the Command and General Staff College. He's also an author of quite a few books. We had him on previously to discuss his book, The Agents of Innovation. Some of those topics we'll try to fold in today as well. He's also published A Military History of Japan, from the Age of the Samurai to the 21st Century. And with another guest of ours, D.M. Giangreco, he co-authored Eyewitness Pacific Theater. You can also find his work in a variety of articles and editorials. And also, he got a little award for his hard writing back in 2011 with the Mankato Prize for the Society of Military History. You can find a link to all of his other previous books out, but he also has, just in time for the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, a book called Battle of Waterloo and Napoleonic Warfare, The Operational Art of the Great Campaign. So we'll have another excuse to have him on. But John, for today, welcome back to MinRats.
Be back.
Wanted to just go ahead and kick it off for what I kind of mentioned in the intro, is when we look back to 1914 as it turned into 1915, there really was a lot of work that took place in the 20 years prior to the First World War that set the conditions for us to be a real world player within the seas dominated by the Royal Navy and a growing Imperial German fleet as well. And we had certain structures in place and certain habits in place that we kept and we moved forward on. And when we look back as trying to develop what we should be doing in the 21st century, there were a lot of people in the last few years, including our friends the Chinese, who are looking back at some of the very influential people from a century ago, in the first few decades of the 20th century. Our friend, Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong, he has his 21st Century Mahan, and he's following that up with 21st Century Sims. And those are two of the characters that not just B.J., but other people are looking at. And in the course of time, there are certain facts that you can get from studying these people. But we also have a certain bit of cultural mythology that influence us today about how we prepare and innovate. As people look back in the First World War, what are some of those myths do you see a lot of people tapping into, whether valid or not, that are influencing today how we're looking to prepare the fleet for tomorrow and innovate as those technical opportunities come up?
Well, it's a very complicated question. The answer to it is very complicated, but I'll start out simple. It was a time of great change, both in the Army, in the nation itself, the United States, in the world, and in the Navy and the Army. So there was a lot of a lot of profound change taking place, not unlike today, a time of immense technological change. When you think about the technological change that's taking place at this time, it dwarfs what's going on today. Yeah, we have iPhones and we have all this technology and we have, you know, processing power doubling every 2 years and stuff like that. But to kind of replicate the kinds of changes that are going on back then, I mean, we would have to be populating other galaxies with, you know, spaceships that could travel at the speed of light. And we're not doing that. So there was an immense amount of change that people were dealing with. And the attitude was not the attitude that we have today, which is a very negative, pessimistic attitude, particularly in the West. It was a very progressive, positive attitude. These were problem solvers. They weren't just in the United States, but the United States prided itself on being sort of the problem-solving nation. We were practical. We used Yankee ingenuity to overcome difficulties. We're going to solve just not just problems of international relations, but we were going to solve problems of domestic problems, and we were going to create this society that was a model for everybody. And this is called American exceptionalism sometimes. But it was very well grounded in the way Americans felt about themselves 100 years ago as the Great War raged on in Europe in 1915. Specifically for the Navy and the Army, huge organizational changes. The kinds of changes we get after World War II with the 1947 National Security Act and then its various modifications in the years immediately after that, those were the kinds of things that were happening in 1900, 1904, 1915, just massive organizational changes. And let me just give you a few of them, some of them directly related to the fact that global naval war had broken out. The Navy creates its first ever general staff, the General Board of the Navy. I've talked about that before, but it's clearly that's what the Navy was doing. The guy behind that is not so well known, Henry C. Taylor, sort of our version of Helmut Moltke, except he's not famous, a man who specifically modeled the processes and the strategic planning of the Navy on the German general staff. Another big change was in the Army with something called the Root Reforms. And after the Navy had created its general staff and its Naval War College, which had actually been created before our general staff, the Army finally got around to creating the Army War College almost 15 years later. And then with the Root Reforms, they created the Chief of Staff of the Army and the Army General Staff, again, after the Navy, but more explicitly identified as a general staff, not like the Navy did. The Navy kind of hid it and made it look real civilianized and called it the General Board. And then in 1915, the Navy... another guy that we never hear about. We always hear about Mahan and Sims and Admiral Dewey, and we should hear about Admiral Dewey. I'll talk to you a little bit about that. I hope you have a question on my research that I just finished on Admiral Dewey. But we don't hear about Bradley Fisk. Bradley Fisk is like Taylor, except even more devoted to establishing this navalist general staff to control American foreign policy and maritime strategy. And so he's the guy who basically skip echelons the Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, and gets the legislation that creates the Chief of Naval Operations. And the United States has probably got the best strategic setup of any nation in the world at that point. They have a strategic general staff, the general board, they have the Army general staff, which is full of very well-educated, very, very dynamic people like General Fox Connor and Pershing and a lot of really bright young officers like Doug MacArthur and George Marshall and George Patton and Dwight Eisenhower. And so we get all of this organizational, institutional change that's kind of taking the United States towards becoming a global power with the hierarchy and the scaffolding for very, very formalized but intelligent and innovative approaches to crafting strategy and matching the ends and ways of an army and a navy with the global responsibilities for a nation that might soon have to go to war. Of course, the nation is neutral at the time and aggressively neutral, I might add, but they certainly were not unprepared, at least intellectually, for the challenge that came. So I want to emphasize for your listeners, it's this massive amount of change that's going on, and these guys are really handling it, I think, pretty good when you think about how they handle the challenge. We could go back and take a look at how they did it, and they did it with a very positive outlook and a very good attitude, a progressive, positive, optimistic outlook. You know, all of them were very much positivists. So, and today, of course, we're all negative. Everything's horrible, and the world is falling apart, and you know, the oceans are going to melt, and everything's a disaster. That's certainly not the way they looked at it. And even with the Great War raging in Europe, they still thought, hey, you know, we can make the world a better place. So, a fascinating era to take a look at change and how to deal with global crisis.
Well, let's pull the thread on the development of the General Board, and to do that, I think you have to go back to the Spanish-American War and the acquisition of the Philippines, Guam, and Cuba from that war, and you add to that Mahan's book, and then a bunch of people looking at what this does to the global picture for the U.S. What led to the development of the General Board, and if you want to, you can run with you know, we had war plans. There was a lieutenant named Kimball, I think, who helped write War Plan Orange and War Plan Black. Can you kind of discuss those things and set the stage for our involvement in World War One?
Okay, no problem. I got to, in fact, one of the things I wanted to see is I want to take a look at the General Board war planning for World War One with Germany. And actually, the last war plan, I'm looking at my notes here right now, the last war plan that the General Board helps craft is the May 1916 mobilization plan for a war in the Atlantic. And that's the last war plan that the General Board helped author. Now, we're going to go back to the beginning and answer all of your questions, but I wanted to give you sort of where it ended in terms of what the General Board did, because the year before, the Chief of Naval Operations was created, and they took over the war planning function. Fisk wanted that. He wanted the Chief of Naval Operations to take over the war planning function, but the General Board had to kind of cover for the new organization and the new office of the Chief of Naval Operations. And so I'll get back to that in a second, but I did want to let you know that the General Board, even after the creation of the Chief of Naval Operations, the General Board was very much carrying the load until the Chief of Naval Operations really got itself up and running. The guy who's going to come out with the latest scholarship on that, by the way, on the CNO is Tom Hung. He's been called back to active duty with the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and he is writing an institutional history of the Chief of Naval Operations, and that should be good news for everybody in the naval history community. All right, well, back to the Spanish-American War. Well, all these guys, particularly Henry Taylor, who ends up being Dewey's chief of staff at three times in his career as a naval officer, but Captain Henry Taylor, later Rear Admiral Henry C. Taylor, for a time the chief of the Bureau of Navigation, which was very heavily involved in war planning prior to the creation of the General Board, he had argued along with Mahan and along with Luce and along with a guy named Goodrich, who later became president of the Naval War College. They all argued that the Navy needed a general staff. Up to that point, up until the Spanish-American War, what the Navy did was they hid their general staff inside the Naval War College. So they did all their war planning inside the Naval War College, where they war game. They had the Kriegsspiels, just like the German general staff. And so they played with the war planning function and kind of hid it inside the Naval War College. And this isn't anything new. This has been kind of known for a while. The problem was, how do you make that work when you go to war? Because the Naval War College kind of closes down during the Spanish-American War, and it'll close down again a little bit during the Great War, during World War One. So at the time, the Secretary of the Navy was John D. Long, a guy who had been picked by McKinley. Now, McKinley picked Teddy Roosevelt to be the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and at that time, we didn't have a Chief of Naval Operations. The precedent was Gustavus Fox in the Civil War, who single-handedly created this new office, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Now, the office was done away with after the Civil War, but it was brought back during the era of what I call naval reform, when the Naval War College was created, when Mahan took over as president and Luce was significant in its structure, when we built the first all-steel Navy as we went from the famous ABCD fleet, where we only had really three steam steel pre-dreadnoughts, and then we went to the all-steel pre-dreadnought Navy. So they had this, but Long said, no, I don't want a general staff. That's militarist, and it's like the Prussians. So there was this sort of bias in the United States against militarism, and so they were kind of fighting that. They were also fighting inside the Navy against folks like Ramsey, who was the Bureau of Navigation guy that hated Mahan and said he wrote him bad fit reps and said he shouldn't be writing books. And then there were the bureau chiefs who were very jealous of their prerogatives against both the Naval War College and against the assistant secretary of the Navy, as well as against any proposal for a general board. So there was institutional pushback inside and outside the Navy. Well, the Spanish-American War was a disaster, particularly for the Army. All right, particularly for the Army. For the Navy, they put together an ad hoc strategy board or war strategy board. And initially, it was Teddy Roosevelt as the assistant secretary of the Navy and Mahan and several captains who were on that board. Well, TR, of course, wanted to go and get his medals and his war glory and everything, so he vacated the assistant secretary of the Navy office to go fight in the war. But after the war was over, the lesson learned was that we need to do a better job at planning, and the Naval War College, with its planning and wargaming functions, just wasn't up to speed. And so Henry Taylor, I think at the urging of Admiral Dewey, who thought the world of Henry Taylor, I've read his letters back and forth with Taylor, and he relied heavily on Henry Taylor. Henry Taylor wrote a memorandum for Secretary Long that said, we need a general staff. Well, Long said, no, I don't want to call it a general staff, but you know what? We'll create something called the General Board. And we've got this new war hero, Admiral George Dewey. And, you know, the nation is wild about this guy because he wins this great Navy victory at Manila Bay, a very, very famous Navy victory. And the battle is really fought to keep the Philippines from falling into the hands of the Germans. I don't know how many of your listeners know that, but Dewey really goes down there, and again, Taylor is his chief of staff, and fights that battle to keep the Philippines from falling into the hands of a German squadron, which is also based in China. So Taylor, as Dewey's sort of right-hand man, writes this memo and gets the Secretary Long to establish the General Board in March of 1900. And so I've been looking at all that correspondence while I was looking at the World War I stuff. And the General Board is established, and it is absolutely a general staff. And as time goes on, it's called an experiment, but because of the way secretaries of the Navy come and go under first McKinley and then under Roosevelt, they're changing every couple 15 months. There's not a lot of longevity. For a time, actually, we've got the great-great-nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte as the Secretary of the Navy, Charles Bonaparte, the grandson of Jerome Bonaparte. And they have all these Secretaries of the Navy, and none of them see fit to disestablish the General Board, so the General Board gets more and more influential and more powerful until 1909. There's a conference in Portsmouth, and the General Board is given complete sort of veto authority over warship design and fleet design, and Norman Friedman has written about this, and Tom Hone and I've written about it as well. And that's when the General Board really kind of establishes itself as the big guys on the block. But they never get named a general staff. In the meantime, Dewey is running this thing. And initially, I thought Dewey was more like Mahan, you know, keep the fleet together, do this. But Dewey really is one of these progressive sort of Prussian approach to war guys. He completely agrees with Henry Taylor that this is a general staff and that he is the chief of the general staff. So his, you know, sort of assistant chief of the general staff for operations is first Henry Taylor, and then later it's Bradley Fisk. So these are sort of the guys that are behind the scenes that your readers might not know about, oftentimes it said, well, they just kind of shunt Dewey off, you know, to this meaningless job in charge of the general board, which, you know, is just a bunch of kind of old men just kind of shuffling around in this office. But that's not what they're doing. They're a very, very important group of guys, and they have an immense amount of power and influence, but some of them aren't satisfied. They want more, and Bradley Fisk is one of those. He says, we need to control foreign policy of the United States. I mean, he's very literal about it, and he sometimes goes around Dewey. Even though Dewey heavily relies on Bradley Fisk, he sometimes Fisk is a little bit too aggressive, but that helps Dewey out. You know, you're the boss. This is one of the things that I saw in the Navy, you may have seen in the Navy, where you get the kind of the figurehead. Dewey is the figurehead, but he's not the stupid figurehead. He's the intelligent figurehead. He gets a guy like Fisk or a guy like Taylor to kind of work behind the scenes, and then he can kind of stay in the background and then give little pieces of authority and say, hey, listen, Secretary Daniels, this is a really good idea that Fisk or Taylor have, but here's what I think we should do with it to make it work so that we don't, you know, risk this. And he does that again with another very good Secretary of the Navy, George L. Von Meyer, who's another really great Secretary of the Navy. But Dewey is not a disinterested party in the General Board's history for the first 17. He really is the president of the board. He is the chief of the general staff, and he knows it. And he knows it. And this is what really kind of popped out at me at my research. So this is where we are in 1914, just prior to the world crisis that summer that causes the Great War.
How did the General Board deal with innovation? For instance, I believe, you know, one thing we talked about on a different venue, my grandfather, both of my grandfathers actually, but my maternal grandfather was on the USS Arkansas as a gunner's mate. And when she was with the British fleet at the end of World War One, because she was still a coal-fired battleship, and that the end of World War One was right that scene between coal shifting over to oil. And our most recent SecNav is when he was pushing his Great Green Fleet idea, kind of pushed the idea that the Navy somehow had its own industrial policy, and that's how we could help build a national green fuels procedure. I'm not sure what exactly the history of that is, but that was one of the arguments he made. And the Navy a century ago in the General Board, did they try to make the military an agent of innovation, as in creating new technologies, or did they have smart leaders who were looking out on what were those rising waves of technology in the civilian sector and how they could take that and best apply it to the military equipment that they wanted to build for the future?
Well, the short answer to that is both. The short answer to that is both. The amount of innovation that I've seen during the period is rather substantial, and the board has already bought into the idea, one, of electric drive using steam turbine engines, either coal-fired steam turbine engines or oil-fired. But the board very, very early on, because it had this bureau of experts in the Bureau of Steam Engineering, quickly recognized the big advantages of you going with oil-fired boilers for steam engineering and hooking those up to what they called at the time electric drive, which meant that you could go forwards and backwards in a ship. You could back down. So it was a really big development. The Navy really bought into it. It's often been said, you know, all the admirals wanted to do is spend their limited dollars on battleships, but everybody always forgets that the Dreadnought itself had just been invented in 1906. So it's a brand new revolutionary piece of equipment. So, you know, when people kind of poo-poo battleship admirals, they forget that the modern battleship, as we understand it, had just been invented in Great Britain. The Navy is already working on these ships. Mahan has some concerns about them because he thinks they'll gobble up all of the budget. And Mahan is the hand kind of parts ways with Sims. There's a very public debate between him and Sims in proceedings, mostly Sims. Mahan writes his piece and then kind of sits back and lets Sims and a bunch of other people fight over it. And Mahan is worried that the fleet is becoming unbalanced with these super dreadnoughts and everything. And he writes about that the year Dreadnought is created in 1906, or the year after in 1906, because the Dreadnought really kind of comes into fruition with Jackie Fisher in 1905. So there's a lot of innovation going on. The thing that really surprised the heck out of me, Sal, was Josephus Daniels, how innovative he is. He gets dissed so much in the naval histories by people. There's a brand new article. There's a brand new biography out on him, by the way. But here's Daniels. You know, and Daniels is always portrayed as this teetotaling guy who took away the wine mess. The rum ration had already been taken away from the enlisted troops. You know, so and Daniels isn't going to give them back the grog ration. But to make it more fair, he takes away the wine ration or the wine mess from the officers. And he's a pacifist. He's a newspaperman. He's all these things. But he's bright. He's the guy who does the Naval Consulting Board that gets Thomas Edison involved in innovation during this time period, innovation for torpedo batteries and stuff like that. He's the guy who's kind of underwriting along with the Navy admirals in the various bureaus, the stuff that's in Tim Walters' new book about naval radio and naval command and control and new signals and how do you use wireless and all that kind of stuff. And Daniels, one of the most innovative things he does during the war reminds me of some of the stuff that we're doing now. After we enter the war, you know, all of the things that the General Board had been telling the Secretary in their secret, nobody, you know, this stuff isn't in the newspapers and in the Internet like it is today. There's no leaks. People kept secrets back then, you know. People took their oaths seriously back then. And the huge problem is the submarine war. And how to fight the German submarines are winning the war, and the General Board recognizes as much, and Sims knows as much, and Benson knows as much, and Dewey knows as much, and so does Daniels. And Daniels says, "Listen, I want everybody. I don't care who you can be, an ensign or higher, but how do we win this war?" And he sends an all-nav. Now, if your listeners don't know it, I know you know what an all-nav is. I don't know if Eagle One knows what one is. But this is the naval message we still have today. And it's from the Secretary of the Navy to the entire Navy. And it's supposed to be read on the mess decks and in the wardroom so everybody can hear it. And he sent an all-nav out to the entire Navy saying, "I want ideas on how to win this war." And he didn't specify on land or at sea. And then he goes, "You know, send all of your responses to the Department of the Navy," and guess who read all the responses? The General Board. And they worked it, and they went through these things, and they looked, and it was almost most of the stuff that came in. There were something like 60 papers that I went through, and there were even more than that. And then the General Board would read a paper, they built this matrix, and then they'd send it to the department or whatever in the Navy, whether it was the Office of Naval Intelligence, the Chief of Naval Operations, the Bureau of Steam Engineering, the Bureau of, you know, this, the Director of Naval Aviation, who at that time was this guy named Captain Mark Bristol. It wasn't Moffett yet. And they sent all of these, and they said, "This has merit, this doesn't have merit." They sent form letters out, "Hey, we're interested, you know, you're interested in national defense, but I think we're already working on that." Or they would say, "Hey, this has real merit. We're going to send it to the Bureau. You might hear more about it." And they worked this thing through the whole time. So an extremely innovative, total, it's kind of like you see in proceedings, you know, we're like, "Hey, we want good ideas, write in," you know. And kind of like, you know, Admiral Stavridis in the right, publish, you know, think. But it was Daniels who said, "I want everybody to write and think," you know, think and write, actually, in that order, and then send it to the Navy Department, and I'll give it to the General Board, and then they'll figure it out, and they'll be the clearinghouse. Now, at first, I thought it was like he's just doing this to keep the General Board busy, but no, that he had such immense respect for Dewey and the General Board. Now, Dewey dies in 1917, but Dewey's successor is a guy named Charles Badger, Admiral Charles Badger, and Daniels thinks nearly as highly of Charles Badger as he does of Dewey, and Daniels doesn't like the Chief of Naval Operations, William Benson, You know, they don't have a very good relationship. So he's actually more relying on the general board than he is on the chief of naval operations. He kind of puts up with the chief. And, oh, by the way, what body is the chief of naval operations a member of? The general board. So you know, the chief of naval operations is part and parcel of the general board. He's not separate from it. He's a sitting ex officio member on the board. So just an incredible amount. So I read through some great papers on mines, how to use mines, how to use airplanes. And one of the big things is the board says, you know, the biggest priority is to support naval aviation. I've read letters from the board from 1916 where they're saying, this is our number one priority. We need to give $5 million to naval aviation right now to buy seaplanes to hunt submarines. We need that money right now. This is our highest priority. And the only thing higher was to support the convoy operations with escorts. So there's a lot of stuff that's out there that hasn't really gotten looked at and hasn't really been thought about. So yeah, the answer to your question is both. You've got both innovative people and innovative organizations. And now I think an innovative Secretary of the Navy who hasn't gotten credit for being nearly as innovative as we think because he supports the president. He has to be real careful about what he underwrites, or President Wilson's going to say, you're fired, you're not neutral enough.
When you talk about the submarine threat and kind of a belated reaction to it, it seems, is that because the General Board did not recognize in advance of World War One that the true potential for submarines and the damage they could cause?
Well, nobody knew what nobody knew. We got to keep the timeline in order here, and that's part of the problem, because I've looked at General Board studies prior to our entry into the war in 1917 where they said, yes, the submarine is a huge threat. We didn't expect this. And you can read about it, and it'll be, you know, when I do my paper for the naval thing in the fall, I'm going to talk about this. But they do. They say the battleship is still the naval court of the realm. And Jutland doesn't do anything, by the way, and Jutland occurs in 1916, doesn't it? Doesn't do anything to sort of undermine their opinion here. We also have to remember the German unrestricted submarine campaign they quit it in 1915 with the sinking of the Lusitania, which was, you know, carrying war contraband into Great Britain, and so was actually a legitimate target, even though the German didn't use legitimate cruiser rules. But it was also a merchant cruiser. We all know that now, too, although the guns weren't yet installed on it. So it was a Q-ship with a bunch of tourists on it. But despite that, everybody knew the challenge of the submarine, and the General Board agreed. But it wrote a couple very, you know, and people like Tom Hone and others have said, see, the General Board underestimated the threat of submarine. Well, everybody underestimated it. The Royal Navy still underestimated it, too. The General Board, I would say, in the U.S. Navy, institutionally and culturally, were probably a little bit ahead of the Royal Navy because they were saying things like, we need more destroyers. We're going to need a lot of destroyers because of this new threat. We're going to need naval aviation. In 1915, I looked at the priority list. We need naval aviation because it looks like that's going to be useful against these submarines. And, of course, you know, they don't really know how bad the submarine is until 1917. Now, Dewey dies in January 1917. But in 1917, the Germans drop all pretense, and they've been building new submarines, building new bases in the portions of Belgium that they've captured, building new types of submarines that are more effective, more long-range. And in, of course, January 1917, they unleashed and with no holds barred the unrestricted submarine campaign. And they'd already been sinking a lot of British ships under regular cruiser warfare rules, and then in 1917, they start sinking everything. And they sink the entire South American grain crop, not just the ships, but the food. So Europe is about to starve. France, Italy are Hoover after the war. They hire President Hoover to do the study. So the Navy is not different. Our Navy, the U.S. Navy and the General Board, estimate the threat so much as they don't know what the threat is. It's kind of a black swan event. The Royal Navy doesn't know either. And actually, the U.S. Navy is ready to go and prepared. They get 35 destroyers ready prior to joining the war. And once the war begins, Daniels and sends Sims over, and Daniels offers 35 destroyers so that the British can start convoying. And up to that point, the British had not convoyed yet. They had decided that was probably what they should do, but they didn't think they had enough escorts in the U.S. Navy's 35 destroyers are sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back in the Royal Navy to start convoying. The other thing, of course, is how immensely useful naval aviation is against the submarine. Submarines are operating for the most part in the daytime back then. They're really submersible torpedo boats. They're sinking a lot of ships with guns. The Germans actually managed to sink more ships and more tonnage in from January 1917 until November 1918 than they will in any two-year period in World War II. It's an incredible submarine defense, and it's very, very dangerous, and everybody recognizes how poor it is. But the General Board is I wouldn't give them a complete pass, but I think they're not doing anything different than anybody else is in terms of understanding just the monumental nature of the threat. And the only people that kind of really understand how dangerous and effective this weapon is are really the Germans, who are willing to say, screw international opinion, screw these people. We're going to send these terrorist platforms to see these roving, improvised, explosive devices, and we're going to blow up these convoys, all right? And I use that analogy specifically because I had plenty of friends in Iraq who escorted convoys being blown up by terrorist methods of warfare. So it's no different, all right? The shock that Americans endure in 2003, 2004, and after with the IED and the suicide bombers in Afghanistan, Iraq, it's the same shock. And were we ready for that? Nope, we weren't, you know? So I don't think there's a failure here. I just think it's the enemy getting a good one in as they throw international law to the side and say, we're going to do whatever it takes to win this war. So my take on the General Board is they're actually ahead of the power curve. They're a much more progressive, reformist, innovative organization than they've been portrayed, again, because they write that the battleship is still the naval coin of the realm the same year that the Battle of the Dogger Bank is. And they still kind of say that in 1916, the same year that the battleships that Jellicoe has push the German high seas fleet back into the bottle and put the cork back in on the Jade River. So I think I have a pretty good position there that I can defend.
I liked in your response to the initial question in the show, you brought up a point that I don't think can be made enough, is the era of 100 years ago was just the technological change one saw in a 20-year period is just mind-numbing when you look at it on a timeline. It's one of the reasons, one of my pet peeves of many is people who will say today, you know, this is an unprecedented time of change and development. It's like, no, it's not. You look back 10 years, we haven't really changed that much compared to what people have seen in previous centuries. And this is one of those times. And whether you're talking about the call for ideas and the racking the stack and the papers they got in, I think it's always useful to reflect on the fact this was a period of very low communication turnaround times. There was no computers. There really were no telephones. There was snail mail. That's about it. But they managed to be fairly nimble and fairly accurate on those innovative opportunities to take those, intellectualize them, put them on paper without computers, get some engineers and smart minds working on it and creating things that displaced water and made shadows on ramps. And does some of that have to do let me ask it, but what was their bureaucratic infrastructure like? Was it, compared to what we have right now, was it a more flat organization? Is that what enabled them to be so nimble? Was the bureaucracy they work in? Or did you just have a perfect storm of the right leaders with the right mindset at the right place in the right time?
Well, you did have a storm, and the storm is World War I, the Great War. And as a forcing function for change and innovation, you cannot undervalue value what it does to everybody's thinking, because so many things that people had thought and assumed about the world turned out to be inadequate to the challenge of the crisis. But in terms of hierarchy and organization, actually we go from a very kind of flat Navy where you have these all-powerful bureaus, but it's flat on sort of the bureaucratic administrative side, but on the operational side, there's nothing. There's a Secretary of the Navy and nothing else. After the Civil War, they get rid of this really innovative office, the Office of the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, where you have this civilian who had been a naval officer kind of acting as the Chief of Naval Operations during the Civil War. So you've got the flat bureaus, the old bureau organization, and you've got the fleet. And so you've got sort of a flat administrative structure who supports the fleet, but they're not involved in any sort of war planning. They kind of do whatever the Secretary of the Navy tells them to do, and in the lack of guidance, they make it up, okay, which sometimes is good, all right? But they're supremely administrative organizations, not really concerned with operations. And then on the other hand, you have the fleet. And the fleet itself is evolving at this time. It's not much of a fleet. But then all of a sudden, and during the Spanish-American War, you get the fleet and you get a new office, you know, Cincas, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet. And so this new office emerges of the commander, and you really don't have that until the Great White Fleet. And the Navy, the General Board, starts to look at this and say, how do we deal with this? So what you have is some of the old and some of the new. And so what happens is, as the Navy and the men in the Navy, the reformers I call them, Mahan, Luce, Taylor, Dewey, Fisk, and some of the secretaries of the Navy, like George Alvin Meyer, maybe less so Daniels, although I'm still trying to make up my mind about Daniels, but I think he's more for the good than for the bad, to be honest. They're trying to kind of, you've got an overlap between the old way of doing business and the new way of doing it. You still have the bureau system. And, you know, the Bureau of Navigation has always tried to kind of be sort of the war planning bureau, because Henry Taylor is in charge of it, Fisk is in charge of it, and then Fisk makes himself this you know, chief, you know, the chief aide of the General Board for, you know, but he's also at the same time, he's the Bureau Head of Navigation. So you're getting all these new organizations that are out there, and instead of putting one person in charge of everything, they put this board in charge of everything that answers to the Secretary of the Navy. So you're creating echelons of control. And in creating this thing, you essentially create a very collegial, collaborative sort of outfit. You still have the bureaus that are very jealous of their prerogatives, but they've been beat down. And by the time that the Great War comes along, the bureaus figure it out. We're not independent. You know, we've got these other organizations that can give us marching orders, and they're called the Chief of Naval Operations and the General Board and the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet. So the Navy kind of stumbles fortuitously, although I wouldn't quite call it that, because at every step of the way, the naval intellectuals like Taylor and Mahan and Sims are thinking about what's the best way to organize for success. So it's not so accidental as it's so sort of like, oh, this works, let's do this. This works, let's do this. Let's keep this. Let's go this way. Hey, let's create a two-echelon naval general staff. We'll have a Strategic General Staff, the General Board, will have an Operational General Staff, the Chief of Naval Operations. And we've still got the Naval War College, which has all kind of goodness with it. And so you really get an interesting sort of organization. It's complicated. It's complex for its day. But if I had to say, is it stovepiped? There's some stovepipes left over from the bureau system. Is it flat? It's a lot flatter than a lot of other things that I see out there. Certainly it's a flatter organization than the Japanese have, flatter than the Germans have. And what's the challenge? What's the strategic challenge here? And what's the strategic context for these guys? They absolutely believe they're going to be fighting Germany. That's who they prepare for war with. Ed Miller's done a great book on War Plan Orange, and they start writing War Plan Orange in 1909. But War Plan Black is the war plan that's got the priority here. They come up with this slogan, let's build a Navy second to none. And in 1914, they talk about that in a memo in May 1914. This is 3 months before the Great War breaks out. And they are saying, hey, our enemy is the Germans. The Germans are who we have to worry about in a war in the future. And let me read part of this from the passage. The General Board believes it would be wise under the present political and naval situation of the world, and probably for years to come, to have two squadrons of the fleet in the Atlantic from May to September inclusive, and never be divided that they cannot be concentrated well before war at this time. The squadron in reserve would be strategically located in San Francisco and Bremerton. And that's what they wrote before the war broke out. And then when the war breaks out, they make clear that everybody knows that, you know, they're neutral, but the enemy, the threat, is Germany for the Navy second to none. And Daniels is buying into this Navy second to none stuff, all right? But he's keeping it all under wraps with the General Board, classified. Everything the General Board does is classified. Nothing gets shared. And Daniels is brilliant in this sense, as is Dewey, because they, and this is strategy we're talking about now, Sal, Daniels puts kind of a gag order on all the Navy officers about talking about the war. But what he does is he keeps Dewey in the Navy. Dewey, the only admiral of the Navy we've ever had in the Navy. Sometimes we call him a six-star admiral because of that. And he's this guy who wears a suit. He doesn't wear a uniform to work every day, even though he's on active duty as the senior admiral in the Navy. And Daniels keeps him in the Navy. So now Dewey can't be used by either the peace activists or the preparedness people. And so, and Dewey figures this out real quick and takes advantage of it. So people write him and they go, hey, we want you to talk about our lack of preparedness or our lack of neutrality or why we're not more, you know, against the war. Why aren't we? And Dewey says, I can't do that. I'm on active duty. I'm the president of the General Board, you know, so I can't do that. But inside the General Board, he works aggressively to prepare for a war with Germany.
You you had an interesting article in Cicero magazine, I think in
I knew
July,
that was gonna come up.
July of this year. let me ask the question you put in your title, John, because the title of the thing was What 1914 Teaches Us About Naval Warfare Today. So what does 1914 teach about naval warfare today?
Well, you know, the a lot of the stuff that's in that article is kind of focusing on the current debates and everything, but the real problem in 1914 is how to conduct power projection in the near land environment. All right, the Germans have not quite figured out that their asymmetric response is going to be to go, you know, after British commerce. They have a commerce component of their strategic plan, but you know, their real plan is really to sort of whittle the British down with a fleet and being strategy, and then eventually gain command of the sea in a big naval battle for the agents, you know, the German Trafalgar. All right, but the real challenge is this near land environment power projection piece, and that's what's really bugging everybody. I mean, they're still trying to figure out the lessons learned from the Russo-Japanese War, and the big problem in the Russo-Japanese War was not so much how to keep the Russian fleet from showing up, because the Russian fleet's already beat when it shows up. The problem is to how to keep the Russian fleet from interfering with Japanese power projection in mainland Asia. That's the problem. And how to operate against, you know, minefields, and how to operate and keep your ships up to speed in a near land environment to support power projection. So you know, I'm kind of departing a little bit from my article by saying, you know, the challenge here is you've got a world in crisis. You've got sort of new modes of warfare, or not new modes, but the old modes are being challenged. And sort of the old ways of doing business need to be looked at. You know, and I've made no secret that I think Jerry Hendricks is on the right track here, Captain Jerry Hendricks, retired, now at another institution somewhere in Washington. But I think he's right. We need to think about things in a, we need to be, you know, we don't need to throw away the old. I'm not a throw away the old and just do the new. I'm an interim guy. There's things in the legacy force that are extremely useful. But there's a lot of new ideas out there, and so we need to be real careful. And the world's a dangerous place. In May 1914, when the General Board wrote that memorandum, that's what they're saying. They're saying the world's a dangerous place, and we got to be ready for it. We don't know what's going to happen, and I think we got to give them some credit here. They did split the fleet. They said we still need to keep something in the Pacific. Because we're not sure about what might happen in the Pacific. Remember, too, there was a war in Mexico going on that we were involved in that nobody ever talks about. And the General Board was very, very focused on that. Frank Friday Fletcher, Jack Fletcher's uncle, is the guy down there supporting that. And there's both a Pacific and a Gulf of Mexico component to that campaign that's also going on in 1914. So there's a lot going on. The world was in crisis, and I think, you know, we can learn a lot today by kind of looking at how they're juggling all of these things. You know, here's this intervention, you know, that's going on at the same time that there's real problems in Europe. You know, there's some strange things going on in Europe, and there have been all these crises in Europe, but general war hasn't resulted, and, you know, the funny movements going on inside Russia. You know, and the Ottoman Empire is falling apart, you know, and let's talk about it. East Ukraine, and there's odd stuff there. And is Europe, you know, the peace of Europe is at risk here, and nobody knows what's going to happen, and everybody's nervous. And oh, by the way, here's the Arab Spring, and the Arab world is now in an uproar, you know, and it's even worse. You know, just in the last week, you know, the King of Saudi Arabia died, his brother takes charge. He's probably going to die, sort of reminds me of the Soviet Union, you know, as they're going, Brezhnev dies, and then Ogarkov, and then Andropov. And here you've got ISIS, and we've got an intervention here. We've still got some guys in Afghanistan. You know, you make the analogy of Afghanistan with Mexico, you know. We're in Mexico doing, you know, counterinsurgent operations, supported by the Navy, by the way, down in Mexico, and trying to figure out how to get the hell out of there, you know, and having a hard time doing it. So on top of everything, we've got problems with the border, the southwest border, you know, the one that goes from California to the Gulf of Mexico. And there's terrorists that are raiding into New Mexico and slaughtering American citizens in Columbus, New Mexico. You know, there's people blowing up and killing people in the United States today in ungoverned areas along our border, narco traffickers and terrorists and stuff. So there's a lot of things that rhyme. I might bring that up. So, and a lot of it is in the naval realm. You know, is the aircraft carrier, you know, still as efficacious as it once was? Jerry's argument, my argument is, no, it's not. It's extremely useful in peacetime, though, or near war, what you might call the troubled peace or the hard peace or the what's another way to say it? We historians all have all kind of names for this. You know, the permanent peace for permanent war peace that we're in right now, you know, where we've always got some campaign going on somewhere where we're using Navy air primarily to do all the fighting, which I've also complained about. Like, well, why, you know, okay. So, and that's on the plus side, but it should tell us something. Like, well, if we've got so much combat power out there, why does it always have to be naval aviation? Okay, I mean, I'm glad. I'm not complaining that the Navy's there to do the job. But there are better places to do these jobs, okay? The Eastern Med has got a lot more maneuver space. The North Arabian Sea has got a lot more maneuver space. There's a lot of maneuver space in the Philippine Sea. You know, so we can be smarter about how we do sort of these near-war, low-intensity conflict, even though it's not low-intensity for the people doing it, type stuff. And I think the carrier's ideal for that, all right? But I'm not convinced that the aircraft carrier is going to be the heavy lifter in the next big war, all right? And I hope there's not a next big war. But we have to really think hard about how we're going to apply combat power in the future. I mean, the guys at Leavenworth have dealt with this for years and years, for Leavenworth, the college that I teach at. You know, they go and they do this crazy exercise in what they call the GAT, the Georgia-Azerbaijan Armenia scenario, and it's the GATT scenario, and Turkey is the other, was what the T is for. And guess where the operation is? It's on the Caspian, and they want to leverage naval power. And it's like, well, one, you're not going to get any USN ships with major power projection capability in the Caspian. Two, it's going to be hard to get anything into the Black Sea because of the Montreux Convention. So, and so for years, they have already been kind of wrestling with some of the problems here of how to do this. You know, when you can't get the nuclear-powered CVNX, you know, USS Bill Clinton through the frickin' Bosporus. You know, so anyway, these are some of the things that I was thinking about as I kind of ranted on with that little piece in Cicero.
You know, it was interesting about the carrier debate, and I think you touched on it a little bit. And in the few minutes we have left, I can ask you to answer 90 seconds, was probably a 90-minute answer. Besides the strategy,
I'll try to keep
of,
it short.
Besides the strategy of our strategy is to build aircraft carriers. You know, what is the connection between our institutional affection and desire to keep building larger, more expensive aircraft carriers and the strategy that we see for maritime power to support our national security interest? Is the tail wagging the dog, and is the capital that we're investing in the aircraft carrier, is that somehow warping our strategic views of what we need to be prepared to do over the next few decades, besides build more aircraft carriers?
Well, if we think that the carrier is the tail that's wagging the dog, we're partially correct there. Yeah, I mean, there's some good things to have that tail wagging the dog. One, you maintain infrastructure. You maintain capability, okay, with these huge shipyards that can produce these huge ships, all right? So that's sort of the plus side. I'll get to the strategic side here in a second. Of course, the other thing, too, is they're nuclear. So you're still maintaining that. You know, I mean, Rickover tried to do what they did at the time of the General Board in World War I and everything. He tried to switch the Navy entirely over to what he thought was the new clean energy source of the future for emotive propulsion of naval ships, which was nuclear power. And we had the whole surface nuke experiment, which was expensive and difficult and everything like that. But we tried to go that way, and until we discover cold fusion or something like that, I don't know if we're going to try that again. But we are maintaining the capability to produce these maritime power plants for these big ships that I think we should maintain, because we also put them on submarines. So I think there's some goodness there in maintaining that capability. But I do think we've gotten strategically lazy, you know. I mean, I cringe every time I hear somebody say, the president asked where the carriers are. Of course, how often does he really say that? You know, who's really asking where the carriers are, you know? I mean, we always hear it, but does he really say that? You know, is it Samantha Rice who's saying that, or who's saying that, you know? So I'd really like to see who says that. I mean, somebody's probably asking what's the closest air power, and then eventually we figure out, well, the closest easy air power is the aircraft carrier, because we don't have to worry about bed down in somebody else's country, you know, because we were too stupid to get bed down rights in Iraq, you know. God, I would hope we maintain some air bases that we can operate almost unilaterally out of in Afghanistan. But if we don't, I mean, shame on us. You know, we're still there, you know. So, you know, we kind of get back to your question about punch them in the nose and leave, you know, or some of these other things that I've written about it. But we did punch him in the nose, and we didn't leave, but we pulled a lot of people out. But so I think there's a strategic question to ask. So when we talk about the aircraft carriers, I think it's made people lazy strategically, and I think there's other things there. But there's other tails wagging the dog, and guys like Admiral Holland are sitting there with smug smiles on their faces, because they know it's something that's there that doesn't get talked about, but it's going to get funded, and that's a recapitalization of our strategic bomber force. Our strategic bomber force, of course, is an undersea strategic bomber force with one-way strategic nuclear bombers. And that is going to get funded unless we are immensely stupid. And I can't believe we would be that stupid. And if we get the one tail, the part of the tail that's the aircraft carriers that are so damn useful in peace and in low-intensity conflict, and we somehow cheat out that other piece, which is our nuclear deterrent containment piece, which it turns out we probably still need, then I say, yeah, now we're going to have some problems here. And we do need to look at some other ways of doing business. You know, we've gotten used to not losing Americans in wars, even though we've lost quite a few. You know, if we lost as many people in these wars to wounds as we did in Vietnam, the casualty rate for Afghanistan and Iraq combined, it would start to approach the wall, the Vietnam Memorial, in terms of people who died. There's a lot of people who should have died in those two wars who didn't because of the revolution in healthcare that's occurred. And we haven't talked much about that, and we don't talk much about that, and we should. But it has kind of made Americans a little lazy that way. So, you know, kind of a long answer there, but I think we have to be real careful about that. I'm not ready to get rid of all the aircraft carriers. The other thing is we've got a lot of aircraft, and everybody's building them, by the way. You know, let's go back to 1914. The battleships are obsolete, right? All the people with 20/20 hindsight writing today, you know, look, the General Board was stupid. You know, Sims was stupid because Sims was a battleship guy right up until the moment he got over to London and started fighting submarines. And, you know, they were so stupid. And when was the last battleship used in combat? 1991. So I don't think the aircraft carrier is going anywhere soon, and I see great possibilities for the aircraft carrier with new technologies. Particularly, I'm looking forward to the first hybrid mix aircraft carrier with manned and unmanned air vehicles on it. I'm looking forward to that. In fact, I can kind of see it in my mind in the future of this smaller nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. It's got incredible range for its unmanned systems, and they're taking off of a second flight deck between the hangar bay and the flight deck, while you've still got that airborne capability, that manned airborne capability on the flight deck. So I built some hybrid cut platforms. And as I've already written about in the Agents of Innovation, we had a hybrid platform ready to go prior to World War II that probably would have led us to the angled deck flight carrier 10 years, even 15 years sooner than we found it, and we kind of threw it away. So I'm big for experimentation. I'm not big on radical change and radical change in the design of the fleet, but I certainly think we need to give these new ideas a chance. And we need to remember, there's a couple tails wagging the dog out there. And those big SSBNs and SSGNs, they're a big tail, too. If we recapitalize the Boomer Force, we're also going to recapitalize our cruise missile submarine force at the same time.
You go on.
That's
hey,
it.
Looks like
that's the answer.
I'm still here. We've already used up
they
about
got,
our
guys are cogitating over that, you know, imagining an aircraft carrier and a cruise missile submarine and a ballistic missile submarine. But yeah, our ballistic missiles, we should get rid of the other two legs of the triad right now. We can't do it any sooner. That money is money that's not being well spent. We shouldn't have manned bombers anymore with nuclear weapons. Get rid of those things. Okay.
Let me get rid of the
missiles that are in the ground.
Let me ask you one more question before we let you go, and we're going to let you go after you answer this question. Back in 2010, you wrote that the war that lasted from 1914 to 1989 was over. But a lot of stuff we see going on in the world today seems to be tied to the end results of World War One. You know, because the whole Middle East was designed after the war to end all wars. Would you extend that now? That comment that it ended in 1989.
Well, you know, everybody always quotes William Faulkner. You know, the past isn't past; it's not even over. And then, of course, the other one that the historians love, you know, and it's on the National Archives, and it's the size of Franklin Roosevelt's desk when he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and he made it that size. It's on the National Archives. On the back, the past is prologue. World War One absolutely shapes the world we're in today. It still shaped the world we're in. We just finished paying off the debts from World War One. World War One saw globalization, the first globalized world at war. And again, the political decisions that were actually, I bring up a map for my students today from 1919, and it looks more like the world today than the map after World War II. So I think World War One has really shaped things, and it's still shaping things. of course, everybody knows, you know, the way that the British and the French and the great powers kind of dealt with the Middle East after the Great War because of Sykes-Picot and some of these other things, you know, that those lines on those maps are only today being dissolved. They're only today being dissolved. The what happens to the Ottoman Empire when it goes away? It sort of went into a time freeze. It was like somebody said, "Hey, let's take this and put it in a jar on Funk and Wagnall's ports, hermetically sealed, and then 100 years from now, we're going to have to open it up and continue to figure this out because the Ottoman Empire is no longer sort of the paradigm for the Islamic world." And that's what we're dealing with today. But that's what we're dealing with today with Russia. Russia actually, you know, is back, you know, to what it looked like 200 years before World War One, you know, and all these nervous states are over there in the Baltic. So World War One is still with us today. It still has an incredible impact on how we see our own present. It's still, and that's the biggest concern people have today. World War Two is really just, you know, the last 6 years of the 30 years war that began in 1914. And the thing that people worry about, the thing that should consume statesmen, generals, admirals, people who are interested in the development of humanity is, how do we avoid another catastrophe of that scale? Because it really looks a lot like we have the same ingredients sloshing around in the global dynamic in 2015 that they had in 1914.
And on that note, it's been a really fast hour. Matter of fact, it was such a fast hour, we added an extra 8 minutes to it. But I'll tell you what, John, I really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to come join us. What's the next thing we can look for from you this year?
Well, if you guys, after I finally get the book out on Napoleonic Warfare, the Operational Arts of the Great Art of the Great Campaigns, I've got an entire chapter in there on Operational Art at Sea. So, you know, maybe we can play with that a little bit.
Perfect. Well, hope you have a great end of the January, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Sal. Thanks, Iguan.
Thank you, John. It's been great.
Yes, sir. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And please join us again next Sunday, where our guest will be Brian McGrath. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.
Welcome to Metro PCS.
Hi, I heard you're giving free phones to everybody?
Yes, right now everybody gets a free phone. You and your friends, cousins, neighbors, roommates.
What if I'm already with Metro PCS?
Yeah, it's for existing customers, new customers, people named Willie, dog lovers.
That's awesome.
Everyone gets a free phone at Metro PCS. Come choose your select free phone from brands like Samsung and LG. Metro PCS, wireless figured out. Sales tax not included. Phones free after instant and mail-in rebates. Upgrade fee may apply. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Welcome to Metro PCS.
Hi, I heard you're giving free phones to everybody?
Yes, right now everybody gets a free phone. You and your friends, cousins, neighbors, roommates.
What if I'm already with Metro PCS?
Yeah, it's for existing customers, new customers, people named Willie, dog lovers.
That's awesome.
Everyone gets a free phone at Metro PCS. Come choose your select free phone from brands like Samsung and LG. Metro PCS, wireless figured out. Sales tax not included. Phones free after instant and mail-in rebates. Upgrade fee may apply. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.